It's great to see you here this morning. I do mean that because it's amazing how many people, when you have the carol service in the evening, sort of, you know, skive off in the morning. So I was just wasn't sure how many people there'd be here this morning, that's all. But it's great to see you. I know time flies when you're having fun, and some of you are going to find this hard to imagine, but this is actually my 7th Christmas in Ipswich. 7th. I know, it's really dragged, hasn't it? I know. For some of you, 7 years in, I'm still the new vicar. You know, and the jury's still out. And what you need to realize is you're still the new congregation. And the jury is still out on that one as well. A lot changes. A lot changes in the experience of a minister. Just as the years go by. Inevitably, there's more history. There's deeper relationships begin to develop. There's trust. And over time, people invite me as a minister, as a vicar, as a pastor, into their lives, usually at times of great trauma. And at times of great crisis. It means I get really distorted visions of you all. Because most of you never talk to me. And then suddenly you invite me into your life at this moment of tremendous pain. And struggle. And things are very, very intimate. For you know, what is hopefully quite a short period of time. And as a minister, what that does to me over the years as I lead you in worship, as I seek to proclaim Christ to you, it changes, it affects how I speak. Because as the years go by, I know you. Some of you, at least. Some of you I've walked with through incredibly difficult circumstances. Some of you I know some of what's going on in your life. Some of you, I know the struggle that it is just to get up in the morning and make it through the day and get into bed at night. Some of you, I've learned over the years the scars that you carry and that you wear. Some of you, I've sat with you at hospital beds. I've buried people that you have loved. I've walked with you when the wheels have come off and everything just feels overwhelming and it feels like there's no way through. That changes how I preach. It changes how I lead. And it means in moments like when we've just shared communion together, you know, I'm like outwardly what you see is I'm coming to you and I'm giving you the bread or the wine and I'm saying the words of the liturgy, but like my heart so often is crying out to God and saying, oh God, this person, like, you know, they need you. They need you. They need everything that this bread and wine represents. Everything that the scriptures say, this moment conveys to them. They need to know your spirit meeting with them in this moment, feeding them, strengthening them, sustaining them, because like, and I only know a part of what's going on. But when I'm putting that bread into your hands, my heart is crying out and saying, oh God, please, you need to come. You need to step into this person's life. Because what they are going through, the burden they are carrying, is so significant. The pain is so deep. They need you. You know, years and years and years ago, and we are talking a lot of years ago, I used to think that most people's lives were fairly straightforward. And there were just a few people who had a little bit of misfortune and difficult circumstances to overcome. Now, I'm like, no, everybody is on the rack at some point. Shadow of suffering is cast over all our lives. There might be a few people who seem to swan through life pretty unaffected. But for most of us, our life is characterized by frustration and difficulty and brokenness and pain and loss and grief. Most of us bear deep, deep scars that sometimes just don't seem to heal. And that's normal. That's normal. It's so easy, isn't it, to fall into the trap of coming to church and looking around and everybody's got their game face on, haven't they? Everybody's like, oh, yeah, oh, yay, we're here worshiping Jesus, life's great. And you think, oh, I'm the only one. Am I the only one who just wants to sit here and cry this morning? Am I the only one who has struggled just to be here? No, you're not. I think you'd be surprised. Well, maybe you wouldn't be surprised. But there is so much pain. There's so much brokenness. There's so much struggle in this room. We're just ordinary people living very ordinary lives. Living those lives in a broken, fallen, and cursed world. We're living lives that are riddled with sin. And we're living in a world where sin is deeply embedded. It's a broken world. And sometimes the sharp edges of that world cut into us, and we bleed. And the thing is that becoming a Christian doesn't change the world. Becoming a Christian, it changes us. It changes us. We become part of this new creation. It changes us. It doesn't change the world that we live in. The world stays the same. It stays, at least for now, a broken, fallen, cursed world. You know, when we celebrate Christmas in a couple of days, yeah, we will talk about Jesus as the light coming into a world of darkness. Now, we usually think of Jesus as the light. Yay! Yeah, but the world is a world of darkness. It's a world of confusion. It's a world of pain. It's a world of grief. It's a world of loss. It's a world of struggle. It's a world of brutality. It's a world of injustice. It's a world of sickness. It's a world of weakness and brokenness. And we have to try to make sense of that world. And we have to try to figure out what it means to live as a Christian in that world. Now, sometimes you'll hear churches or preachers preach in a way that seems to suggest that when you become a Christian, somehow you're protected from that. Somehow you're lifted out of that. Somehow all that brokenness, that's not going to affect you anymore. You can live this different, victorious kind of life that means that suffering doesn't plague you anymore. That's so dangerous. And it's so naive. And worst of all, it is so unbiblical. The Bible is never naive about the reality of this world. In fact, I would suggest to you that actually the Bible is probably the only place where you can begin to really understand what this world is like and why it is like that. But part of my job is to help you not just see from the Bible what the world is like and why the world is like this. Part of my job is to help you to answer the question of how do I live as a Christian in this world? As a Christian, how do I make sense of this? What's my life supposed to be like? Who am I supposed to be in the midst of all of this? How do I find in my faith, in my relationship with God, in the worship and the fellowship of the church, how do I find in the scriptures the resources, the vision that I need to know how to navigate this world? Because sometimes it can seem overwhelming. Sometimes it seems like there's no way through. Sometimes it feels like I'm just being crushed and it's all I can do to survive. Well, Isaiah 35, and this whole section of Isaiah, but particularly Isaiah 35 this morning, is beginning to answer some of those kinds of questions. And it's interesting, isn't it? Like I've just been saying about how the Bible's not naive. The way in which Isaiah 35 acknowledges the realities of the world that we live in. The kind of images that it's using to capture the reality of life in this world. Isaiah 35, verse 1. It's a parched land. It's a wilderness. It's a desert. Hostile environments where life is hard. Environments that seem to crush life rather than allow life to flourish. It's a world where things don't work like they should. It's a world where life is hard. But this world, this age, this cursed, old, passing, broken creation is not the last word. The Bible tells us that this world, this old creation, will be rolled up like a dirty old garment and will be cast aside. That there will be a new heavens and a new earth, a new creation that is not scarred, that is not broken, that is not damaged, that is not fallen, that is not laboring under the curse. That all of creation, in a sense, will be resurrected into a whole new way of being. A way that is characterized by justice and holiness and splendor and glory. It's what Jesus calls the renewal of all things. You catch it in Romans 8. When the Apostle Paul, one of the earliest Christian leaders, talks about how creation is like creation, not just us, but all of creation. It's like groaning under this bondage, and it's looking forward, it's longing for this day when it will be released from this curse, and it's able to become everything that God created it to be. It's able to become again a world that God can look at and declare it to be good. You just get a flavor of that hope, again, in these opening verses of Isaiah 35. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. The parched land will be glad. It will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly. It will shout for joy. See the contrast, the total transformation that creation undergoes. But it's tempting to think, well, that's it, isn't it? That's our hope.
That's our future. That's, you know, we look ahead to that, like Jesus in Hebrews 12, where we're told that for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. And we're thinking, okay, well, we've got this joy, we've got this future, we've got this hope, we've got a light at the end of the tunnel. And that's going to help us to persevere and to endure and to stay faithful here and now. But actually, the renewal of creation is not the focus of our hope. And I have to say, I'm really quite glad about this, because I am deeply scarred when it comes to things like crocuses. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can remember as a 7-year-old kid, my gran used to come and stay. And I don't know if this is still inflicted on 7-year-old boys, but when my gran came to stay, that meant we had to visit National Trust properties, which always had gardens, which we always had to walk around very slowly and look at all the flowers. I'll just throw this in as a freebie for you. 7-year-old boys, they don't want to walk around gardens slowly looking at flowers, all right? It was hellish. So the idea that, you know, that my hope is watching crocuses bloom, that doesn't do it for me. So I, for one, am glad that our focus, creation has this hope, this future, but that is not our focus. Our focus is not on the glory of the renewed creation so much as it is on the glory of the God who renews it. The glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. You see, that kind of renewal, that kind of resurrection, it's not just something that happens periodically. You know, universe is just suddenly, bam, there they go, they're transformed, they're renewed. No, this renewal happens because Jesus comes. Because Jesus comes to this creation again, and he breaks the curse, and he restores, and he renews, and he resurrects, and he reclaims, and he gives this creation a future and a hope that it otherwise would not have. The glory, the glory of any fingerprint Bibles in this place, seriously. All right, your duty, strengthen the feeble hands. Oh yeah, they will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. All right, be strong. Do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, and with divine retribution, he will come to save. All right, that's the hope. That there will be justice. That the books will be balanced. That all the stuff that seems so unfair and wrong with this creation, Jesus will come and he will sort it out. He will balance the books. He will bring justice. He will bring retribution. And that is our hope. And there's such a sharp contrast between that this creation and that new creation where Jesus will be, where Christ has returned, where he has broken the curse, where he has renewed creation. That's our hope. We confess it in our creed that we look for the resurrection of the dead. We look for the life to come, when everlasting ages will stretch before us, where we can enjoy intimacy and fellowship with our Lord and with each other in a world that has been made new. That is our hope. But does it have anything to say to us here? Well, in the midst of this vision of transformation, this vision of renewal, this vision of retribution, this vision of justice, this vision of the coming of God, in the midst of it all, there is a call to the church. Strengthen the feeble hands. Steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong. Do not fear. Your God will come. See, it's not enough. It's not enough for Christians in this world just to survive. Right? Even in the midst of agonizing circumstances, it is not enough for us just to survive, just to get through. Right? We are those who bear witness to the glory of Christ, to the sufficiency of Christ, to the goodness and the glory of our God. And if we cannot do that in the darkest shadows of our life, then it means nothing if we do it on the days when the sun is shining. If our faith doesn't work when we are standing at the hospital bed of someone we love, if our faith doesn't have anything to say when we are at a funeral, then it has nothing to say at all. It's in the darkest places of our lives. It's when we are under pressure that we discover what we truly believe. It is when our faith is tested that it can be proved. It's when all our rhetoric and all the songs that we sing and the liturgy that we say, it's all of that comes under scrutiny. And it has to work. It has to be real in the depths if it's going to be meaningful when we climb out of them. We must bear witness. We must be like Jesus when we suffer. Or the fact that we can be like Jesus at other times is radically undermined. To use the imagery of Isaiah 35, steady the knees that give way. Why? Well, because there is a road, isn't there? There's a highway, verse 8. The way of holiness. You need to strengthen and steady the knees that give way so that we can stand and so that we can put one foot in front of the other as we walk through this broken, fallen, cursed world along the path of holiness, along the way of righteousness. I've got to do that. But you know when you're so punch drunk, isn't there times when life just hits you like that? It just hits you and you don't know. Like, where am I? What do I do? How do I get up again? In fact, you know what? Maybe I'll just stay down. Because at least when I'm down, I can't fall any further. That's not an option for us as Christians. The Spirit of Christ dwells in us. And the Word of Christ comes to us. And the Church of Christ is supposed to be there to pick us up and to support us and to help us put one foot in front of the other. Steady the knees that give way. Why? So that we can walk the way of holiness. And that road leads into this new creation. Or again, to use the language of Isaiah 35, this road leads to the gates of Zion. The redeemed walk along the way of holiness. The ransomed of the Lord will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them. Sorrow and sighing will flee away. I can't even imagine what that will be like. So much of life is characterized by sorrow and sighing. I can't imagine what life without it will look like. But I can tell you, it's going to be characterized by singing. It's going to be characterized by rejoicing. It's going to be characterized by gladness, a joy that overtakes us. That's an extraordinary sentence, isn't it? The joy will overtake us. You know, Paul understood this. When the Apostle Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, he had something to say about this. It's in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. I'm just going to read you a few verses from 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Because Paul is going to say something about suffering in a moment. And I want you to know that when Paul talks about suffering, he knows what he's talking about. So listen to this. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 verse 23. I've worked harder. I've been in prison more frequently. I've been flogged more severely. I've been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I'm beaten with rods. I've been stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I've been spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers and bandits, from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles. I'm in danger in the city, in the country, at sea. I'm in danger from false brothers. I've labored and toiled. I've often gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst. I've gone without food. I've been cold and naked. And besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. That's quite a litany of suffering. And then the Apostle Paul, who's lived through all of that, says this: our light and momentary troubles. Our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. And so we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. He says something similar in Romans 8. He says, I consider our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Let me ask you this. When at the end of your pilgrimage, when you've walked the length of that way of holiness, when you cross the threshold of the city of Zion, on that day, when you're resurrected into the new creation, someone turns to you and says, was it worth it? Was it worth it? What do you think your answer will be? In that moment when joy and gladness have overtaken you, in that moment when the reality of the new creation crashes over you like an ocean wave and washes away the sorrow and the sighing and the brokenness, when you're stepping into an everlasting future where you are in fellowship with Christ and you're in fellowship with the church and you're in this new creation and joy, everlasting joy has crowned your heads, when sorrow and sighing has fled, will it have been worth it? Will it have been worth strengthening weak hands and steadying the knees that are giving way? Will it have been worth it to have borne witness to the faithfulness of Christ and the goodness of God, even in the darkest moments of your pilgrimage?
Will you be glad that you've done it? Let me just bring this to a close by reminding you of an incident from the Gospels. It's Matthew chapter 11. John the Baptist is in prison. He's anticipating, I suspect, his martyrdom. And in the darkness of the dungeons, he begins to question. He begins to wonder, is Jesus, is he really the Messiah? Is he really the one that has been sent by God? He begins to doubt. And you remember, he sends two disciples to Jesus just with that simple question. Are you the one who was promised, or should we be looking for somebody else? John's there. He's in the midst of it. His back's against the wall. His life is coming to an end. He's invested everything. And he's put all his eggs in this basket. And in this moment, just not sure. Have I done what's right? Have I been an idiot? You remember what Jesus does? He sends John back to do a Bible study. And the passage that he sends him to is Isaiah 35. The blind see. The deaf hear. The lame are leaping for joy. Now, at one level, what's Jesus doing? At one level, Jesus is just answering the question. Are you really the Messiah, Jesus? Are you worth following? When my back's against the wall, when I'm thrown into the dungeon, when I'm anticipating martyrdom, when the wheels come off life, when it feels there's no way out, are you, Jesus, really, are you who you say you are? And on one level, Jesus is simply answering the question. He's like, well, John, look, here it is. Here are the things that the scriptures say the Messiah will do. I'm doing them. Go figure. On one level, that's what Jesus is doing. But I suspect that he's doing something else as well. That Jesus is dealing with the temptation that John is facing to give up. The temptation that John is facing to capitulate to his doubt. The temptation that John is feeling to give in to his fear. The temptation that John is feeling to let go. To fall to his knees. Not in prayer, but in hopelessness and despair. Jesus isn't just answering the question. Jesus is dealing with that hopelessness, with that anxiety, with the fear that lies behind the question. By taking him to Isaiah 35, Jesus is saying to John, mate, keep going. Strengthen the feeble hands. Steady the weak knees. I'm saying to you, John, you've got a fearful heart, and I'm saying, be strong. Do not fear. Your God will come. Stay on that way of holiness. Keep bearing witness to me. Keep testifying to me. John, you're so close. Zion is in sight. The threshold of the city of God is just beyond the horizon of your vision. Don't give up now. Steady those knees. Keep putting one foot in front of the other. Stay faithful. Walk the way of holiness. Because when you stand inside those pearly gates, and when you are crowned with everlasting joy, and when gladness and sorrow has overtaken you, you won't even pause a heartbeat before you stand and say, it was worth it. It was worth it. So fix your eyes on the glory of the new creation. Remain steadfast for the hope that is set before you. Strengthen your feeble hands. Steady the knees that give way. Those of you who fear, know that your God will come. Because one day, you will know that it was worth it.